Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to this evening's Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley program brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Hazen Jihu and I will be your chair for this evening. It's my pleasure to introduce Joan Allaire, contributing editor of Wired Magazine and author of Imagine, How Creativity Works, which will debut at number one on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list this week. Joan received his undergraduate degree in neuroscience from the Columbia University, where he also served in the Columbia Review. He later attended Oxford University as a Rhodes Scholar and earned his master's degree in 20th century literature and philosophy. Jonah writes the popular Frontal Cortex blog for Wired and Headcase column for the Wall Street Journal. He is the best-selling author of two other books, Proust Was a Neuroscientist and How We Decide, and is a frequent contributor on NPR's Radiolab National Geographic's Brain Games. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Jonah Allaire.
Thank you so much, everyone, for coming tonight. Thank you so much to the Commonwealth Club for having me. It's a tremendous pleasure and honor to be here. I'd like to begin with a story about Bob Dylan. It takes place early in the summer of 1965 when Dylan is finishing up his tour of England. It's been a grueling few months as Dylan has been struggling to maintain a nonstop performance schedule. He'd first traveled across the Northeast on a bus, playing in small college towns and big city theaters. Then he crossed over to the West Coast and crammed in a few hectic weeks of concerts and promotion. He'd been paraded in front of the press and asked an endless series of inane questions, from "What is the truth?" to "Why is there a cat on the cover of your last album?" When Dylan wasn't surly, he was often sarcastic, telling journalists that he collected monkey wrenches, was born in Mexico, that his songs were inspired by chaos, watermelon, and clocks. That last line almost made him smile. By the time Dylan arrived in London, it was clear that the tour was taking a toll. The singer was skinny from insomnia and pills, his nails were yellow from nicotine, and his skin had a ghostly pale pallor. Joan Baez said he looked like an underfed angel. For the first time, his shows felt formulaic, as if he were singing the lines of someone else. He rarely acknowledged the audience or paused between songs. He seemed to be in a hurry to get off stage. Before long, it all became too much. While touring in England, Dylan decided that he was leading an impossible life. The only talent he cared about, this ceaseless creativity, was being ruined by fame. The breaking point probably came after a brief vacation in Portugal, where Dylan came down with a vicious case of food poisoning. The illness forced him to stay in bed for a week, giving the singer a rare chance to reflect. "I realized I was very drained," Dylan would later confess. "I was playing a lot of songs I didn't want to play. I was singing words I didn't really want to sing. It's very tiring having other people tell you how much they dig you if you yourself don't dig you." The last shows were in London. It was here that Dylan told his manager he was quitting the music business. He was finished with singing and songwriting and was going to move to a tiny cabin in Woodstock, New York. Although Dylan had become a pop icon, the prophetic poet of his generation, he was ready to renounce it all. He just wanted to be left alone. Dylan wasn't bluffing. As promised, he returned from his British tour and rode his Triumph motorcycle straight out of New York City. He didn't even bring his guitar. Of course, our story doesn't end here. Bob Dylan did not retire in 1965. After a few relaxing days in Woodstock, just when Dylan was most determined to stop creating music, he was overcome with a strange feeling. It's a hard thing to describe, Dylan would remember, just the sense that you get something to say. So Dylan did the only thing he knew how to do. He grabbed a pencil and he started to scribble. Once Dylan began, his hand didn't stop moving for the next several hours. "I found myself writing this song, this story, this long piece of vomit. 20 pages long," Dylan said. "I'd never written anything like that before, and it suddenly came to me that this is what I should do." Vomit is the essential word here. Dylan is describing with characteristic vividness the uncontrollable rush of a creative insight, that flow of associations that can't be held back. I don't know where my songs come from, Dylan said. It's like a ghost is writing the song. It gives you the song and it goes away. You don't know what it means. Once the ghost arrived, all Dylan wanted to do was get out of the way. In retrospect, we can see that this frantic composition in Woodstock allowed Dylan to fully express, for the very first time, the full diversity of his influences. In these cryptic lyrics, we can hear his mental blender at work as he mixes together scraps of Bertolt Brecht, Fellini, Woody Guthrie, and Robert Johnson. The song is modernist and pre-modern, avant-garde and country western. What Dylan did, and this is why he's Bob Dylan, is find the strange thread connecting these voices. In those first minutes of writing, he found a way to make something new out of this incongruous list of influences, drawing them together into a catchy song. When Dylan gets to the chorus, and he knows this is the chorus as soon as he commits it to paper, the visceral power of the lyrics become obvious. How does it feel to be without a home, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? The following week, on June 15, 1965, Dylan brings the sheaf of papers into the cramped space of Studio A, Columbia Records in New York City. After just four takes, the musicians were only beginning to learn their parts. Like a Rolling Stone was cut on acetate. Those 6 minutes of raw music would revolutionize rock and roll. Bruce Springsteen would later describe the experience of hearing the single on the radio. It's one of the most important moments of his life. The story of Like a Rolling Stone, the reason I'm talking about Bob Dylan, because it's a story of a moment of insight. At times, such stories can feel like romantic cliches, a sort of make-believe breakthroughs that happened to Archimedes in the bathtub and Newton under the apple tree. And yet, moments of insight do happen. They are a genuine mental event. They really are responsible for the theory of gravity and Like a Rolling Stone. In recent years, cognitive psychologists and neuroscientists have made some really interesting progress in trying to understand how this very mysterious mental event happens, you know, as if the cortex is sharing one of its secrets. It turns out there are two defining features of such moments of insight. The first defining feature is that the answer comes out of the blue. It arrives when we least expect it. We write our best song after we've stopped writing songs and moved to Woodstock, New York. The second defining feature is that as soon as the answer arrives, as soon as we begin writing those words down, we know this is the answer we've been searching for. So the solution comes attached with this feeling of certainty. It feels like a revelation. So those are the two defining features of moments of insight. And at first glance, it's not quite clear how one could scientifically study such moments, you know, because you can't just put undergrads in a brain scanner and say, have an epiphany, we're ready for you. That'd be a very inefficient way to collect data. So instead, what scientists have to do, and I'm talking primarily here about the research of Mark Beeman and John Cuneos, Beeman's at Northwestern, Cuneos at Drexel, is find a way to generate lots of moments of insight inside the brain scanner. So what they come up with is a set of word problems called compound remote associate problems. The acronym is CRAP. You can begin to imagine how tired the scientists are of this joke. And the word problems go like this. I'm going to give you three words. We'll do the first one together. I'll give you three words, and you have to find the fourth word that can form a compound word with those three. So the three words are pine, crab, and sauce. The fourth word here is apple, pineapple, crab apple, applesauce. So here's one for you guys. The three words are age, mile, and sand. Age, mile, and sand. Stone. So if the answer came that quickly to you, you either had read the book or you had a moment of insight. We'll pretend it was a moment of insight. And so the first thing Beeman and Cuneos discovered when they gave people these compound remote associate problems is that in the seconds before a moment of insight popped into consciousness, a part of the brain called the anterior superior temporal gyrus, an obscure bit of cortex in the back of the right hemisphere, lit up, showed a sharp spike in activity. It's a part of the brain nobody knows too much about. It's been previously associated with things like the processing of jokes. It lights up when you hear a punchline. And also the interpretation of metaphors. And this begins to make a little bit of sense. You know, when we're watching Romeo and Juliet, and Romeo says that Juliet is the sun, we know he's not saying that Juliet's a big flaming ball of plasma gas. Instead, we know he's trafficking in metaphor. Now, the way we make sense of those metaphors is not by comparing all the literal things that Juliet and sons have in common, because they have nothing in common. On the surface, they seem completely unrelated. Instead, it's by searching for the remote associations, those underlying themes they actually share. Now, so we're able to figure out that Romeo is saying that Juliet lights up his world the way the sun lights up ours. Now, a similar mental process is required when we're trying to figure out what connects pine, crab, and sauce, right? Those aren't three words that go together very often. And what this one brain area seems to be especially good at is finding that one other word, which in this case is apple, that binds them all together. It's able to find that connection that connects these words that seemingly have nothing in common. Now, when you need a big breakthrough, when you're struggling to find to solve a very difficult problem, chances are you also need to bring together a set of remote associations. Because if those connections are on the surface, you probably would have found them already. The reason you need an insight is because they're hidden far below. And that's why you probably need the anterior superior temporal gyrus. So that's the first thing Beeman and Kunios found. The second thing they found is a bit more interesting. And this they discovered when they hooked people up to EEG machines. It's like wearing a big, bulky shower cap. You got to grease up your hair and attach lots of electrodes to your scalp. But what they found in conjunction with colleagues at the University College of London is that they could predict up to 8 seconds in advance whether or not someone was going to have a moment of insight. So they could look at your EEG waves and they could say, sorry, buddy, you are wasting your time. You should just go home. You know, you can sit here and flail all day and you'll never have an epiphany. Or they could say, you know what, in about 7.5 seconds, you may have a breakthrough, so brace yourself. The question, of course, is what this predictive signal is. Turns out to be something called alpha waves. Like most things in the mind, alpha waves remain pretty mysterious, but they are closely associated with states of relaxation. So things that lead to the generation of lots of alpha waves are things like taking a walk on the beach, sitting on your couch with a beer, taking a hot shower, going wherever it is you go that makes you stop thinking about work. That place where you leave the world behind, you just get a daydream and feel good about yourself. That's probably a situation where you're having lots of alpha waves. Now, the reason these states of relaxation are so important for the generation of moments of insight, Beeman and Kunios argue, is that when we're not relaxed, when we're focused, when we're juiced on caffeine, our attention's out here. You know, it's fixated on the world. We're thinking about pine, crab, and sauce. Pine, crab, and sauce. We're running like a broken record inside our head. There's probably a wrong answer. A common wrong answer is tree that we just can't get past. And so we're stuck. We're stumped. It's not until we're shampooing our hair in the shower, feeling good and nice and relaxed, and we can't even check our email because there's no waterproof iPhone. So we're forced to just daydream. When at long last we turn the spotlight of attention inwards, and that's when we hear that quiet voice coming from the back of our head whispering, "The answer is apple. The answer is apple." Maybe that voice has been there for hours or days or weeks. We just haven't taken a moment to listen. Now, there is something counterintuitive about this research because it suggests that, you know, while most people assume that the way to solve a very hard problem is to focus on it, to chain themselves to their desk, to chug Red Bull and triple espressos, that's actually the worst thing to do. Instead, the next time you hit the wall, you should find a way to take a break. You should go on vacation. You should take a long hot shower. You should chug a beer. I mean, a study just came out last month showing that when you get undergrads too drunk to drive, so, you know, more than just a little tipsy, but really drunk, that they actually solve 30% more of these hard insight problems. And that's because, you know, they're more relaxed. They're more likely to mind wander, to turn the spotlight of attention inwards. So, you know, this reminds me of one of my favorite lines about creativity, which is from Einstein. He said, "Creativity is the residue of wasted time. When you are stuck, when you are in desperate need of a moment of insight, you have to make time to waste time." Now, I wish I could stand up here and tell you that the way to solve every creative problem is to take a shower, to go on vacation, to take a lovely, relaxing hike in the woods. But that'd be terrible advice. Relaxation is not a universal cure. As Nietzsche once observed, creators have a vested interest in our believing in the flash of revelation, the so-called inspiration shining down from heavens as a ray of grace. But this is often a lie. In reality, all great artists and great thinkers are great workers. To illustrate his point, Nietzsche described Beethoven's musical notebooks, which documented the composer's painstaking process of refining his melodies. It wasn't uncommon for Beethoven to experiment with 70 different versions of a single musical phrase before settling on the final one. "I make many changes and reject and try again until I'm satisfied," the composer remarked to a friend. The lesson here is that even Beethoven, the cliche of artistic genius, needed to constantly refine his ideas, struggling with his music till the beauty shone through. Let's not sugarcoat. this rejecting process, the process described by Nietzsche and Beethoven, it's not fun. It's the red pen on the page and the discarded sketch, the trash prototype and the failed first draft. Nevertheless, such a merciless process is sometimes the only way forward. We keep on thinking and thinking and paying attention and chugging coffee because our next thought might be the answer. So what defines this kind of creativity? What allows some people to simply persist when others quit? It turns out to be largely defined by a new character trait called grit, G-R-I-T. And this also helps explain a long-standing mystery in creativity research, which is that when you look at people on the far right side of the creative bell curve, epic creators, Bob Dylan, Pablo Picasso, Steve Jobs, you try to figure out, well, what makes them so special? Why? What makes them different from us? It's really not clear. You know, you can give them an IQ test, and it turns out they're not smarter than the rest of us. Their IQ falls within the normal distribution. You give them a battery of personality tests, you know, these old-fashioned tests like Myers-Briggs and all the rest. Once again, they look pretty ordinary. They may be a little bit more open to experience, but that's about it. Instead, I think what really separates these people on the far right side of the bell curve is that they're grittier than the rest of us. They are more likely to persevere, to persist, like J.K. Rowling, who suffered through 12 rejections from publishers but kept on writing about Harry Potter in coffee shops while her baby daughter took naps. These people are just more stubborn. They simply refuse to quit. The best way to explain the importance of grit is to tell you a story about supermarket cashiers, a story that takes place in the early 1980s and involves a psychologist named Paul Sackett. He's now at the University of Minnesota. And he was approached by a large chain of supermarkets to find a way to identify their fastest cashiers, the people who in the checkout line could check out the most items and the most customers. Sackett thought about this for a little while and realized, oh, this is a fairly straightforward problem. He filled a cart with items, 100 items, and asked the cashiers to check out these 100 items as fast as they could. And he stood there alongside their boss with a stopwatch. And sure enough, you find that some people can check out a lot more items per minute than others, that speed varies. And so Sackett measured 800 cashiers, turned over his head to the company and says, look, I found your fastest cashiers. Here's the bell curve, and they're on the right side. Those are the ones you want to keep. Those are the ones you want to give bonuses to. This is called a maximal test. You're trying to measure maximum performance. You assume people are motivated. They want to go as fast as they can because they know their boss is watching. So you just want to see what they're capable of, how much talent they have inside, how good their hand-eye coordination is, and so on. Like it turns over his data, and then he assumes his work is done. But he can't stop thinking about this, right? Because he realizes that at about this time, electronic scanners are introduced in supermarkets. He thinks to himself, well, if I just got access to that scanner data, then I could watch how fast people were going, how many items they checked out, without even needing to give them a test. I could just measure their typical performance over the course of a day, a week, a month. So he gets access to the data, and sure enough, he gets a second bell curve of cashier performance. Some cashiers check out a lot more items and customers over the course of a day and a week. And then Sackett has the bright idea to compare these two bell curves, to see if the fastest cashiers on the maximal test are also the fastest cashiers on the typical test, the typical record of performance. And what he finds is that the correlation between these two bell curves is essentially zero. It's about 0.1. And in most cases, it's statistically insignificant. That it doesn't tell you, that these maximal tests don't tell you very much about how they'll do in the real world. This is known as the maximal typical distinction. And I would argue it's a pretty important problem. Simply because we live in a world obsessed with maximal tests. From the IQ test to the SAT to all these tests we give prospective employees, we assume that the way to predict typical performance, which is what we care about, is to see how much talent people have inside, to see what they're capable of on a short, high-stakes exam. And yet, in field after field, these maximal tests fail to predict what actually counts, which is performance in the real world. One of my favorite examples of these failures is the NFL Combine. The NFL Combine is this festival, this carnival of maximal tests. Every player in the NFL draft has to go to Indianapolis and do the 40-yard dash and bench press and vertical leaps. You know, they take a short version of the IQ test called the Wunderlic. The assumption of NFL teams, of course, is that how people do on all these maximal tests will help them predict typical performance, how these people actually do in the pros. Well, what two economists at the University of Utah discovered last year is that the NFL Combine, massive waste of time and money. that all these maximal tests are useless. The only exception, the only maximal test, the combine, that tells you anything at all about performance in the pros, performance on the field, is the 40-yard dash for running backs. Every other maximal test tells you exactly nothing. Now, the reason these maximal tests so often fail to predict typical performance returns us to grit. Because what you can't measure by definition in a short exam, in a 10-minute test, in a 3-hour multiple choice quiz, is grit. Grit is something over the long term. It's how you put in those 10,000 hours. It's how you perform when you don't think anyone else is watching. It's how you react to frustration and failure. It's about the macro timescale. That if maximal tests measure talent, typical performance, it's about talent plus effort. Grit helps you measure effort. Now, I think some of the most interesting work on grit has been done by a psychologist named Angela Duckworth. She's at Penn. And she first discovered grit in conjunction with West Point, because West Point had this problem where for years and years, for decades, they lost about 5% of their first year cadets during beast barracks, during the first 6 weeks at West Point. It's, you know, when you get your head shaved and you go on long runs and you wake up early in the morning, it's a tough period. They turn squishy citizens into hardened soldiers. And this was a big problem for them, because there are no transfer students at West Point. So if you lost these kids, they were gone. Future leaders of the Army just disappearing. So West Point had searched in vain for metrics that predicted retention. They looked at all sorts of maximal tests, SAT scores, measure the physical fitness. Nothing worked. In 2005, in desperation, they approached Duckworth. She comes up with this test called the Grit-O Survey. It asks questions in two domains. First domain is, how single-minded are you about your goal? Have you always wanted to go to West Point? Have you always wanted to be a novelist, be a, you know, an entrepreneur, a computer scientist, whatever it is? Second domain is, how do you react to the inevitable frustrations that happen as you try to accomplish the goal? Are those frustrations and failures a sign that you should try something new? Or are they saying you should double down and try even harder, work even harder to accomplish your goal? So those are the kinds of questions she asks. And what she discovers is that her simple Grit-O survey is the first test West Point has ever administered that helps them predict retention. They've since used it every year since, and it works every time. Since 2005, Duckworth has gone on to show that in field after field, levels of grit are the single biggest predictor of success in the real world. So if you're looking at the National Spelling Bee and trying to figure out which 12-year-old is going to win the National Spelling Bee, it's not the smartest ones, not the ones with the highest IQ scores, not the ones with the best grades. It's the ones with the highest levels of grit, because grit mediates deliberate practice. Grit is what allows you to put in those 10,000 hours of work. Grit is what allows you to practice the right way, which is not the fun way. If you're trying to figure out which teachers are going to be able to make it to the first year Teach for America, it's the grittiest ones. Which graduates of Wharton Business School are going to make the most money? It's the grittiest ones. Which cadets are going to be able to become U.S. Army Rangers? It's the grittiest ones. In field after field, Duckworth has shown that levels of grit predict success simply because they capture the effort part of the talent plus effort equation. And it's not just about how hard you work. It's also about, can you put in the time to even develop your talent in the first place? Now, this brings us back to creativity, because I think grit is especially important in creative domains. And that's because the act of making something new is always going to be hard. If it were easy, that product would already exist, that novel would have already been written, that patent would already have been filed. If it were easy, it would have been done. It's hard. It's going to be hard. It's going to involve endless drafts, endless iterations, lots and lots of frustration and failure. In order to persist on through, you're going to need to be really gritty. Woody Allen has this great quote. He says, 80% of success is just showing up. Well, grit is what allows you to show up again and again. So far, I've been attempting to describe these two very distinct forms of creativity, which depend on very distinct mental processes in the brain. The more practical lesson, though, is that different kinds of creative problems benefit from different kinds of creative thinking. The question, of course, is how to adjust our thought process to the task at hand. When should we daydream and take warm showers, and when should we drink another cup of coffee? What requires relaxation, and what requires grit? The good news, and I think this is very good news, is the human mind has a natural ability to diagnose our problems, to assess the kind of creativity we need. These assessments have an eloquent name. They're called feelings of knowing, and they occur whenever we suspect that we can find the answer if only we keep on thinking about the question. One of my favorite examples is when a word's in the tip of your tongue. You know, it's a very frustrating mental state. You're walking down the street, you see someone, you know their name, an old friend from high school, an acquaintance on Facebook, but you just can't quite place it. On the one hand, this is just drives me crazy, but it's also kind of a profound mental hiccup, because how do you know something if you don't actually know it? You know, like, why are you so convinced you can remember that name if you can't find the memory? Well, this brings us back to feelings of knowing. That feeling of knowing is a hunch telling you, you know what, if you just keep on looking for that name, eventually you will remember it. Eventually you will find it in one of those overstuffed file cabinets inside your head. Now, when it comes to creative problem solving, feelings of knowing are often essential. Numerous studies have demonstrated that when it comes to problems that don't require insights, don't require a sudden flash of revelation, the mind is remarkably accurate assessing the likelihood that a problem can be solved. We can glance at a question and know that the answer is within our reach if only we put in the work. The end result is that we're motivated to stay focused on the challenge. Now, what makes these feelings of knowing even more useful is that they come attached with a sense of progress. This was first demonstrated by Janet Metcalf at Columbia University. She has people working on various creative problems that they feel like they're getting warmer or closer to the solution. What she discovered is that when you give people problems that are typically solved in a moment of insight, so you need those remote associations, there is no feeling of knowing. They went straight from freezing cold to burning hot. The answer arrived all of a sudden in a sudden rush. However, when people worked on problems that didn't require insight, so-called analytical creative problems, they only solved the problem after they reported a gradual increase in warmth, which reflected their own sense of progress. Now, what's impressive about such estimates, what's kind of miraculous, in fact, about such estimates, is that people were able to assess their closeness to a solution without knowing what the solution was. This ability to calculate progress is a very important part of the creative process. When we don't feel that we're getting closer to the answer, when we've hit the wall, so to speak, we probably need an insight. In these instances, we should rely on the right hemisphere, which excels at revealing those remote associations. Focusing on the problem will be a waste of mental resources. We will stare at our computer screen and repeat our failures. Instead, we should find a way to relax. The most productive thing we can do is forget all about work. However, when those feelings of knowing are telling us that we're getting closer, then we need to keep on struggling. We should continue to pay attention until it hurts, to rely on those muscles of grit. Before long, that feeling of knowing will become actual knowledge. The last idea I'd like to just end with very briefly today is a provocative one, and it speaks directly, I think, to the difficulty of fostering innovation, even in a place like Silicon Valley. In fact, it suggests that many of the things we do with the best of intentions, from holding brainstorming meetings to the hiring of chief innovation officers, that these things actually get in the way. They hinder our natural creativity. I think this is best demonstrated by the work of Jeffrey West. He's a theoretical physicist at the Santa Fe Institute. He studies cities and he gathers vast tracts of data from the Census Bureau and the Patent Office and governments all across the world. And he's interested in how cities tick and what makes some cities tick better. But he also makes this very, I think, interesting comparison between cities and companies. And he points out that from a certain perspective, cities and companies look really similar, right? They're both big clusters of people in a fixed physical space, lots of infrastructure. And yet cities and companies exhibit one very interesting difference, which is that cities never die. Cities are immortal. You can nuke a city, comes back. You can flood a city, terrible hurricane, comes back. Devastating earthquake, we still have San Francisco. Companies, on the other hand, are incredibly fragile. The average lifespan of a Fortune 100 company is 45 years. 25% of Fortune 500 companies die every decade. Only two companies in the original Dow Jones Index are still around. So West wants to figure out, why are companies so fragile, and why are cities so perdurable? Why do cities live forever? Well, what he's found is that cities and companies actually exhibit one very interesting difference. The difference goes something like this. As cities get bigger, as the metropolis expands in size and population, everyone in that city becomes more productive. They make more money, they invent more patents, they invent more trademarks. By every metric we have, they're going to look smarter and simply better. And this gets back to the magic of cities. This is why urbanization is the great theme of the 21st century, that there's something amazing happens when you simply put too many people in the same zip code, that all those bumps, all that human friction, what Jane Jacobs called knowledge spillovers, they add up. All those random conversations on the sidewalk while waiting in line for a latte, every once in a while, they lead to a new idea. That is the magic of cities. That is why, you know, people come together in places like Silicon Valley. This is called superlinear scaling. So as cities get bigger, the curve looks something like this. People become smarter and more productive. In companies, the opposite happens. As companies get bigger, everyone in that company becomes less productive. You get less profit per employee, fewer patents per employee. By every metric we have, companies look sublinear. Now, of course, over time, this is quite dangerous, right? Because Wall Street's saying, grow the bottom line, keep on getting bigger. And so companies get these elaborate fixed costs, elaborate bureaucracies that cost a lot of money to maintain, but they can't generate new ideas at the same rate. So they become more reliant on their old ideas. They've got to invest in expensive acquisitions for the new ones. Sometimes those acquisitions don't work out. And eventually, of course, your old ideas no longer bring in enough revenue. And that's when you go belly up. Now, Wes wants to figure out what explains this difference. Why are cities super linear? Why are companies sublinear? Well, what he argues is that companies get in the way. That the secret of cities is that they don't really try to manage us. That cities are these freewheeling, chaotic places. A mayor is a pretty powerless figure. They can't tell you where to live or who to talk to or what problems to work on. You just go about your day bumping into people. Companies, CEOs, try to micromanage innovation, right? They try to control the pipeline, try to control the process. They tell people what to work on, who to talk to. They tell them, don't take naps, don't waste time, don't play so much ping pong. They try to manage our attention. They tell us to brainstorm, and brainstorming just doesn't work. They erect these elaborate hierarchies. They become vertical cultures, they silo knowledge, and all these things get in the way of our natural creativity. They hinder the innovation that simply emerges when too many people share a small space. So Wes' advice is simple. When in doubt, imitate the city. In closing, the imagination has always seemed like a magic trick of matter, which is probably why we've always blamed our best ideas on the muses. The good news is that by finally understanding where our new ideas come from, we can hopefully have a few more of them. The science of creativity can make us a bit more creative. But we must also be honest. The creative process will never be easy, no matter how much we know about neurons or cities. The science of the imagination doesn't fit neatly on a PowerPoint slide, and it can't be summarized in a subtitle. If creativity were that easy, Picasso wouldn't be so famous. Despite all the clever studies and rigorous experiments, our most essential talent remains our most mysterious. The mystery is this. Although the imagination is inspired by the everyday world, by its flaws and its beauties, we are able to see beyond our sources, to imagine things that only exist in the mind. There was nothing, now there is something. It's almost like magic. Thank you so much, everyone. I very much look forward to the conversation. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you, Jonah. You've given us some hope that we can be creative and challenge us also to be gritty. So maybe to open this up, it seems to me that your book in many ways is a plea to lead an attentive life. We should pay attention to the colors of the walls of our workplace, that we should attend to our sleep, to our other work conditions, to our emotional states, and to make corrections in order to be more creative. So, how are you applying some of these things to your life?
I think there are two big changes that writing this book has produced in my own work life. One is I used to have this mindset that when I was stuck on a sentence or didn't know how to structure a chapter or an article, that, I had to work through it. So I would chug coffee and stay up late. And then, of course, you wake up in the morning and you realize your fixes didn't fix anything, and you're more frustrated than ever, and you're hungover on caffeine, and you're quite miserable. Now I'm much more willing. I give myself the excuse when I'm stuck to take a hike, to waste time. And I don't know if this is an elaborate rationalization to just justify my laziness, but but I have had some good ideas while on these hikes. So that's one way that this book has changed the way I think about work. The other thing is that I do force myself to bump into strangers more. One study that I was quite convinced by was a study led by Martin Reft, a sociologist now at Princeton, and he tracked 766 graduates of the Stanford Business School who had gone on to become entrepreneurs. And he was interested in how the structure of their social network impacted their levels of innovation. And he tracked innovation in terms of number of patents, number of trademarks, amount of revenue from those patents, and so on. And what he found is that entrepreneurs with diverse social networks, people who had friends from all different walks of life, people who had friends who were nothing at all like them, that they were 3 times more innovative than people with predictable social networks. And so this does inspire me. This is a study I think about when I'm on a plane and I just ask a question to the guy sitting next to me. I have become that annoying person people run from on planes, where I want to make small talk during takeoff and landing. When I'm at a conference, I just want to ask questions. I want to meet people. It's not something I'm drawn to naturally, but I do force myself to do it. And this was actually brought home to me in the writing of the book, because this was about a year and a half ago, and I was backstage at a conference making small talk with one of the speakers, and asked the guy what he did for a living. And his answer was, well, I work on floor cleaning. And of course, my first response is, oh God, floor cleaning. This is why you don't make small talk with people. So we're going to have a long conversation about floor cleaning. And then he tells me the story of how we invented the Swiffer. And that story becomes the story I begin Imagine with. So whenever I'm feeling particularly introverted, I remind myself that it's good to ask questions, especially of people who work on floor cleaning, especially of people who think very differently from you, who speak in different languages and use different acronyms and attack problems from different perspectives.
All right. Well, let's turn to kind of a big macro issue. You talk at the end of the book about something called the Shakespeare paradox and the conditions for creativity, not just in your personal life, but also in the life of a whole community. Yeah. So can you talk about the Shakespeare paradox and especially how it applies to Silicon Valley?
Yeah. When I began writing this book, I never thought I'd end up writing about Shakespeare and Elizabethan England. I really thought the book would be pretty tightly focused on their brain and the mind. But when you begin thinking about creativity and you begin reading these articles, you quickly discover that you can't just look at it from the perspective of these 3 pounds of meat inside our head. The creativity is also about cities. It's also about cultures. It's also about, the color of the wall in your office. That it's not just about what's in here, because what's in here, the circumference of the imagination is incredibly influenced by the cultures and cities we live inside. And so this is how I ended up writing about what sociologists call ages of excess genius, which gets us to the Shakespeare paradox. And these are these sudden flourishings of talent you see throughout history. So it's ancient Athens, it's Renaissance Florence, it's Elizabethan England, where you don't just get William Shakespeare, you get William Shakespeare and Christopher Marlowe and John Donne and Francis Bacon, all these immortal geniuses basically living in the same neighborhood in the same time. It is quite befuddling, and for a long time, historians brushed aside these ages of excess genius as basically flukes of history, just random accidents, cloddings that are going to happen every once in a while if you play the tape forward. But in recent years, sociologists have begun pointing out that all these ages of excess genius share some patterns, that there are these recurring themes you see in all these ages. And some themes are, some of the themes are things like the expansion of educational opportunity. So that's one theme you see in all these ages. So Shakespeare's father was a glover, signed his name with the mark, probably illiterate. Yet Shakespeare, because of a reform passed by Queen Elizabeth, was being taught Latin at the age of 8 by an Oxford-educated teacher. Free education. Christopher Marlowe got a full scholarship to Cambridge. So you've seen all these ages of excess genius, a vast expansion in the pool of human capital. People are all of a sudden flooding the zone that never would have been able to do that before. So that's one thing you see. You also see new mechanisms for sharing information. So Shakespeare, for instance, lived at a time in the birth of the publishing industry. So he got access to all these old stories that previous playwrights didn't have access to. And Shakespeare stole a lot of these stories. He if he were alive today, he would violate lots of copyright laws. He didn't like inventing plots, so he liked reinventing them. So he would take this mediocre melodrama called Hamlet and transform it into the Hamlet we read today. And this is a pattern he relied upon again and again. So these are some of the themes that you do see in these Ages of Excess Genius. One thing, you know, one point that I was quite interested in is an idea proposed by Bill James, the founder of Sabermetrics, the brain behind Moneyball, is he points out that 21st century America, we live in an age of excess genius. It's just the geniuses we pump out are a very particular kind of genius. We excel at pumping out athletic genius. We export basketball players all across the world. They have to have rules in Japanese baseball leagues. We only have so many American players. We win the Olympics. We are very, very good at creating physical talent. We're not so good at creating every other kind of talent, but physical talent we know how to do. And James points out this is because we have this pipeline for developing talent, that we drive our kids to Little League and AYSO. We encourage them at early ages. If they're good at it, they play against other good kids. We award lavish scholarships in high school and college. We've trained professional sports teams to make big bets on potential. So they award, you know, million-dollar contracts to unproven draft picks, many of which don't pan out. And yet that money's an incentive for other people to enter the pipeline, other people to try to become basketball players and baseball players and so on. And so at every step of the process, we encourage kids in the right way. And he argues that what we need to do is take those same lessons, which we already know work, and apply them to other kinds of genius, to literary genius, to engineering genius, to, you know, to scientific genius. We know how to groom talent and build talent. We just have to do it now.
And the Silicon Valley connection then would be that there was this ecosystem here that could groom that kind of talent.
Yeah, I think you know, one of the very interesting things Jeffrey West pointed out to me, and he, like I said, he data mined cities, and one of the metrics he's most interested in is number of patents per capita as a measure of innovation. That turns out to be one of the most reliable measures of innovation in a given urban area. And he points out that you go back decades when San Jose and Silicon Valley were mostly walnut and apricot farms. So when this wasn't the high-tech center of the world. That was back in Route 128, the Massachusetts Miracle. He says, but even then, San Jose had some property where they generated a lot of patents per capita. So there was some secret sauce that existed even then, before Silicon Valley had lots of silicon, when it was really a farming agricultural area. It was still very innovative. And, you know, He doesn't have too many explanations for why that might exist. I think there are glimmers of an answer. One of my favorite proposals comes from Annalise Saxenian, who's at UC Berkeley, who she does this great comparison between Route 128 and Silicon Valley. And she asks, you know, if you were a betting person 40 years ago and you're trying to place a bet on which area is going to become the high-tech center of the world, you would have put all your chips on Route 128, right? It's 6 of the 10 biggest tech firms in the world, Wang, Digital, and so on. Got lots of Defense Department contracts. And yet, those companies all went out of business. And the talent all moved to Silicon Valley, and this became the high-tech center of the world. So she wants to know, well, what happened? What led to the downfall of Route 128 and, you know, and the birth of Silicon Valley? And the story she tells is about the grooming of talent. It's about places like the Homebrew Computing Club. To make a long story short, the story she tells goes something like this. It's about the companies in Route 128 were very vertical. So Digital didn't just want to make microchips. They wanted to make the mainframes and write the software that went on them. They put a big, they really privileged secrecy. They didn't want their engineers talking to other engineers. So they actually described themselves as an island in the regional economy. So all these big firms were like islands, and talent couldn't really talk across these companies. So there are very few horizontal interactions. It was a very vertical kind of place. Silicon Valley was very, very different. You always had these engineers hopscotching from company to company. The average tenure of work in Silicon Valley in the early 1980s was 2.5 years. It also helped that in California you can't enforce non-compete clauses, so talent can jump to a new firm when they still have relevant talent. So that was a big advantage. You also had things like the Homebrew Computing Club, places where people could have these informal social networks and teach each other.
Let's turn a little bit to group creativity at this point. You had a provocative statement in your talk there where you said, brainstorming doesn't work. And for those of us who've been addicted to brainstorming, perhaps we should know what you mean.
Well, you know, I should be clear. I think brainstorming is a, you know, can work as a morale booster. It can make people feel good about themselves. That came out more condescending than I meant it to. So classic brainstorming, that's the activity I'm picking on here. Classic brainstorming was first proposed by Alex Osborne, the ad executive. He's the O in BBDO. He's kind of the Don Draper of his day. And in a series of best-selling business books in the late 1940s, early 1950s, he outlines this technique called brainstorming, which is responsible for things like the Good campaign of Campbell's Soup. And he says it's, you know, a transformative technique. Just two simple rules to brainstorming. The first rule is whatever you do, you can't criticize the ideas of others, right? This is a safe space. All ideas are good ideas. If the imagination's worried about being criticized, it'll just clam up. It'll go all meek and shy. So no criticism allowed. Second rule, it's all about quantity, not quality. Quality can come later. But the secret to an idea generation activity is that it's about getting ideas on the wall. Now, as I said, this is a feel-good productivity technique because we can all come into a room, free associate, we fill the whiteboard with ideas, no one gets their feelings hurt, we all leave happy and satisfied. The only problem with brainstorming is that it doesn't work. And study after study has shown that people actually perform better working by themselves than they do when they brainstorm in a group. That they come up with more ideas and those ideas are rated as more original. So brainstorming doesn't seem to be the magical idea generation technique that we've long assumed. And I think we also have good ideas on what we need to replace it with. This is largely the work of Charlotte Namath at UC Berkeley. So her experiments are pretty straightforward. She divides undergrads into three different conditions. One condition is classic brainstorming, so no criticism allowed. Second condition is do whatever you want. Third condition is she encourages students to engage in debate and dissent, to constructively criticize the ideas of their fellow group members. And she asks people to come up with solutions to, you know, traffic in the Bay Area, stuff like that, hard problems. What she finds is that groups that engage in debate and dissent come up with anywhere between 20 to 40% more new ideas. Those ideas are typically rated as more original, too. One of her most interesting findings, though, is what happens after people are done. So they finish the study, and then she brings them back into the lab, and she says, okay, since the study was complete, have you had any more new ideas about how to reduce traffic in the Bay Area? And what she finds is that now people in the debate and dissent conditions have up to 7 times more new ideas than those in the brainstorming conditions. And that's because debate and dissent wakes us up. It's invigorating. It's full of surprises. It forces us to dig below the superficial surface of the imagination because it turns out the surface is pretty superficial. And you can demonstrate this by asking people to, you know, free associate on stuff. So over the decades, psychologists have amassed these, they're called predictive word tables. So I know that if I ask you to free associate on blue, your first answer will probably be green, followed by ocean, sky, maybe Joni Mitchell, maybe Miles Davis. If you're creative, you'll get to jeans. But you won't shock me with your answers, with your free associations. That our free associations are bound by language, and language is full of cliches. So if you want to get past that superficial surface, you want to get past those cliched associations, that's why you need debate and dissent. Debate and dissent is what forces us to dig deeper. It means we've got skin in the game. And that's when things get interesting.
Let's take a few questions from the audience. What is the effect of aging on creativity?
That's an interesting question. I think some of the most interesting work on this has been done by Dean Simonton at UC Davis, and he spent decades amassing these tables of various peak ages in different fields. So peak ages of creativity, because it turns out they're different in different fields. So if you're a poet or you're a physicist, it turns out your peak age of creativity is late 20s, early 30s. If you're a biologist, it's your late 30s. If you're a novelist, it's your mid-40s. If you're a historian, it's the last field to peak. It's early 50s. And these curves, I should point out, are pretty depressing, right? They look like this, followed by this. And to make a long story short, what Simonton argues is that the peak age almost always comes before you get tenure. So it comes before you really have funding and people take your idea seriously. So it almost always comes too soon. Now, for a long time, people assumed this drop-off in creativity with time was inevitable, that the imagination simply decayed, that it fell apart a bit like long-term memory. But that's no longer what scientists believe. Instead, they believe that the drop-off in creativity over time is really a byproduct of what Simonton calls enculturation, that over time, people simply become invested in the status quo. They develop habits and routines. They develop assumptions about how this problem needs to be solved. And it's that process of enculturation that's responsible for the drop-off in creativity. And so Simonton points to people who somehow maintain creativity over the entire course of their career. So people like Bob Dylan, like Pablo Picasso, like the mathematician Paul Erdős. And their secret seems to be that they constantly risk reinvention, that they refuse to stick with the same assumptions. They're always wanting to write a new kind of song, paint a new kind of painting, tackle a new kind of math problem. And it's that constant reinvention that keeps them creative throughout their entire career. So the good news is there's nothing inevitable about the loss of creativity. It just means we have to work hard to get it.
I should have introduced myself before. I'm Tim Ritchie. I'm the president of the Tech Museum in San Jose. So let me ask this. How can technology aid creativity?
It's an interesting question. I think it brings us back to, in a sense, ages of excess genius, because one of the things you see are these new methods of sharing information. So, Shakespeare had books. Shakespeare could take out books from his friends in the publishing industry and see all those stories. And certainly one thing technology has given us is an astonishing new set of interactive tools, new ways to share and store information. So I am bullish in the long term on the potential of technology. I think it could very well play a pivotal role in creating an age of excess genius. But I also think we have to be honest about its limitations so far. You go back 10 years and you hear futurists confidently predicting that thanks to all these new tools we've got, like email and video chats, they talk about the death of geography. That in the 21st century, we no longer need to be tied to physical location. Cities would be obsolete. Why pay expensive rents? Why put up with the crime and the crappy public schools? We can all move to the exurbs and telecommute. We wouldn't have to work in offices anymore. That we get all the interaction we need on our screens. But that hasn't happened. Cities are more valuable than ever before. The pace of urbanization is increasing. People still come to places like Silicon Valley. People spend a lot of money to live in this region. Even though they're working on things and these tools that make it possible to work remotely, they still want to cluster together. They still want those knowledge spillovers. One of my favorite factoids is that since the invention of Skype, attendance at business conferences has nearly doubled. That even though in theory we could get all the content without having to put up with airport security and plane delays and taxi rides, we still know there's something magical about meeting in the flesh, about coming together in person. And I think one way to think about this is that what our tools so far online are so good at is making our lives more efficient, helping us find the stuff we want very, very quickly. But creativity is not really about efficiency. Creativity is often about serendipity. It's about those random bumps on the sidewalk. It's about those chats we never expected. It's about that idea that we were simply distracted by, but then we mashed it up with a new idea, and then we created something new. So in a sense, I think what the next stage of online tools have to look like, if you want them to really become creative tools, is finding ways to maximize serendipity, not just efficiency.
Well, that leads to another good question from the audience. What are the implications of your research on education?
I think in terms of education and creativity, the most important thing we can do is simply not kill it. And sadly, we are very good at killing it. Picasso's got this great quote about every child's born an artist. The problems begin once we start to grow up. And that's actually true. If you survey second graders and ask them, do you think you're creative, 95% of them say yes. You ask that question to fifth graders, and you're down to about 50%. You ask that question to high school seniors, you're down to about 5%. So over the course of K-12 education, kids come to believe they are not creative, that creativity is this rare talent reserved for the lucky few. And it's really a testament to the fact that we are good at killing creativity. So the first thing we have to do is, I think, remind kids, especially during this crucial transition that educators refer to as the fourth grade slump, which is it's in this window of third, fourth, and fifth grade where kids really conclude that they are not creative. And this is in large part because they start to realize that their drawing isn't quite as pretty as they'd like, that you can put the brush in the wrong place, that their short stories don't live up to their expectations. So they become self-conscious and self-aware, and then they shut themselves down. So I think we really have to mount interventions during this crucial window and remind kids that, that drawing can get better if you simply invest in the hard work. If you put in the work, you can become an artist. You can become more creative. So I think we really have to focus on this crucial window that psychologists and educators have identified, which is when most kids conclude they're simply not creative. So that's one thing. I think another thing is we have to expand our notion of what productivity really means. I think right now we are grooming our kids to think in a very particular way, which is we assume that the way to always be thinking is to be attentive, to stare straight ahead, which is why we diagnose 20% of kids in many classrooms as having attention deficit disorders. When the research is actually more complicated, you know, people with ADD are actually more likely to become eminent creative achievers in the real world once they graduate. And this is true at all points in that spectrum. So people who are more distractible, it's called having low latent inhibition. So these are people who look up when the air conditioner turns on, and when they're at a cocktail party, they can't help but eavesdrop on all those conversations going place, you know, taking place around them. So in a sense, we see this as a burden, right? It makes it harder to focus, and that's a bad thing. But this is the work of Jordan Grafman at the University of Toronto. People with low latent inhibition, as long as they have moderately high IQ scores, they are 7 times more likely to be eminent creative achievers. So this is actually a big asset because, you know, when you're distractible, you're always grabbing at seemingly irrelevant ideas and combining them with other ideas. Most of those ideas won't pan out, which is why being smart helps, because that means you can get rid of those ideas quickly. But every once in a while, that new mashup is gonna be useful. It's gonna lead you somewhere interesting. So, in a sense, being distractible is actually, you know, can be an asset. Even the act of daydreaming. You know, one of the first lessons we teach our kids is don't daydream. Stop looking out the window. Stare straight ahead. Well, people who daydream more score a lot higher on tests of creativity. So we have to teach our kids how to productively daydream instead. So I think, you know, we also have to expand our notions of what useful thinking looks like and not just groom our kids for this one very narrow kind of thinking. The last idea I would emphasize, I do think we have to start teaching grit directly. I think we know grit is so important in the real world, and it's a skill that we need to figure out how to teach. Duckworth is just beginning a project to try to figure out how to build it up in kids. She doesn't have any clear answers yet, but you know, she's got this great maxim, which is that if you're trying to teach kids how to be gritty, what you should do is tell them, choose easy, work hard. And what she means by that, it's important to give kids a menu of possibility pretty early on, a menu of things they might fall in love with. Maybe it's painting, maybe it's drawing, maybe it's writing, maybe it's computer science, just a bunch of passions that they could discover. And so they can find these things that don't feel like work, activities that just feel like fun. And then you have to remind them, okay, so you found something you love. You found a goal you want to strive for. Now you have to work hard. Now you have to put in your thousands of hours of practice. Now you have to be willing to persevere through failure and frustration. So I think we have to do a better job of, you know, giving kids a menu of possibility and then reminding them, work hard.
Yeah, that really does relate to another theme in your book, which is the relation, our attitudes toward failure. Yeah. It seems to me getting kids or any of us to persist through failure is something that perhaps we're losing. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, Duckworth makes this very provocative point, which is that she argues that some kids who come from very well-off families, that they may actually, their grittiness may actually suffer simply because their parents never let them fail. That if they're struggling in math, they get 3 math tutors. And that's done with the best of intentions. It's done out of just straight love. But it's actually important for kids to learn how to deal with failure and frustration. That is just part of developing these crucial skills. You know, I think the relevance of failure is particularly important at the organizational level, simply because I think too many times we assume, you know, the path to success is by avoiding failure. That's how we succeed. When, if you're in the innovation business, that is not how it happens. The creativity is always going to involve lots and lots of failure, lots of risk and experimentation along the way. One of my favorite quotes in the book comes from Lee Unkrich, the director of Toy Story 3, and I was asking him, you know, what's the secret sauce of Pixar? What allows Pixar to go 12 for 12, you know, to have one hit movie after another? And he talked about failure. He said, you know, too many companies, they assume that you succeed by not failing, by not making mistakes along the way. When at Pixar, they have a culture which is all about screwing up as quickly as possible, failing fast, and then fixing it. And this begins to explain why Pixar really emphasizes critical group interactions, because, you know, once you realize that failure is inevitable, that failures are simply part of the process, then the question becomes, well, how do we fail fast? How do we identify those failures before it's too late? And that's where criticism and debate and dissent, I think, really become necessary.
Well, speaking of that, when you think about criticism and debate in a group, you also have a provocative section of the book talking about the cue or a quotient of familiarity that is optimal for creativity in a group. Tell us a little bit more about cue.
Sure. This is the work of Brian Newsy and Jared Spiro, and it's a remarkably well-done study. It took them years to do. But they looked at Broadway musicals, and this is because they wanted to study the ideal template for creative collaboration. And they realized that, you know, no one can create a musical by themselves. That a musical, by definition, involves many different kinds of artists with different talents. You need a lyricist, a librettist, a choreographer, a director, everyone taking notes from the producers, and so on. And so what they wanted to figure out is it better for all these different artists to know each other really well, to have worked together before, to be intimate and familiar with each other? Or is it better for them all to be strangers, to, you know, a bunch of newbies thrown in a room together? So what they did was they looked at thousands of Broadway musicals over the course of the 20th century. They amassed this vast social network, you know, for, you know, of all these collaborators who worked on Broadway. They assigned all these musicals a score they called Q. It's a scale from 1 to 5. So if this is a musical where everyone is best friends, everyone knows each other really well, that has a high Q score, a Q close to 5. When Uzi and Spiro went into this, they assumed that plays with a high Q score, that those musicals would be better simply because you'd have a more freewheeling and familiar exchange of ideas. But that's not what they found. They found that plays produced with a high Q score, so, you know, a series of repeat relationships, those musicals tended to fail at the box office and were panned by critics. And critics often use a familiar language. They said, this is more the same old, same old. We've seen this before. So then Uzi and Spiro looked at plays with a low Q score. And what they found is that these plays also tended to fail at the box office. That they also didn't succeed. And critics sometimes, you know, remarked that these plays just, they didn't hold together. It seemed like a bunch of ideas that didn't connect. Instead, Uzi and Spiro found that the most successful Broadway plays tend to be produced with a, you know, within a very narrow sweet spot of Q. So musicals produced with plays with a Q between 2.2 and 2.7 were 3.5 times more likely to succeed at the box office and be praised by the critics. So this is a big difference, 3.5 times more likely. And their favorite example is West Side Story. So this is a musical that at first glance may look like it has a high Q score because it's a series of repeat relationships. You have Arthur Lorentz, Leonard Bernstein and Jerome Robbins, three titans of Broadway who knew each other well and worked together before, but they realized they needed a lyricist with a fresh voice, someone who had very little experience, so they insisted on hiring this 25-year-old guy. Their producers thought they were crazy because he had no track record, but his name was Stephen Sondheim. So Uzi's advice is simple. When in doubt, seek out your Stephen Sondheim. I mean, it helps that he, of course, was a genius. So... If you can bring Stephen Sondheim in, definitely bring him in. But the larger lesson is, you know, you want a little tension in the room. You want a little discomfort. You don't want to just work with your best friends. That'll feel easier and feel more comfortable. That's probably a mistake.
Well, we're just about out of time. We want to thank you for coming to Silicon Valley. It's encouraging to us to hear that perhaps we can become more gritty, more creative. It's important for our country. Good luck to you with your book. It's going to mean a lot to our country.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you very much.
I hope you all enjoyed the program tonight. Clearly, with the applause, I'm sure you have. Again, we'd like to thank Jonah Lehrer, author of Imagine, How Creativity Works, and Tim Ritchie, the president of the Tech Museum, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of us who are being joined on by the radio. And now, the meeting of the Commonwealth Club, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is now adjourned.